Star Walker Studios presents Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. Hello, fellow gamer. Welcome to episode 138 of Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. I'm Lex Starwalker. On this show, we discuss the craft and art of game mastering. Not only do I pass along any knowledge I've gained over 25 plus years of running RPGs, I also share wisdom from guest GMs and listener GMs like you. Today, I'll discuss Chapter 5 of the Player's Handbook, Equipment. You might be surprised how many gems are in this chapter that many of us breeze through or largely skip, including some decisions you can make about how to customize your game. Before that, I have another update to episode 136 on the new encounter building system in the Unearthed Arcana. So join me on the journey. Together, we can become game masters truly worthy of the title. So yeah, another correction at the beginning of the show today. Episode 136, I made the statement that I did not believe that the math used to build the encounters in the Unearthed Arcana article was indeed the same as the math used in the Dungeon Master's Guide, despite Wizards' claim that it was. And in episode 137, I kind of recanted that due to some feedback I had from Christopher Ruthenbeck, who pointed out that it does seem that the math is the same. It's just that the single monster encounter table is building hard encounters from the DMG, and the multiple encounter table is building medium encounters. And that is true. However, there are still discrepancies in the math that another listener pointed out to me, and I thought I would share this with you. Try to be as accurate as I can on this show. So as I said, a listener pointed out the following example to me of one way in which the math is not lining up between these two different systems. It seems like the source of this discrepancy is it seems like the multiple monster table in the Unearthed Arcana is not using the multiplier for larger numbers of monsters. So when you're building encounters using the system in the DMG, once you decide how many monsters or NPCs you're going to have, there is a multiplier that you apply to their XP total based on how many there are. And this is to represent the fact that the more opponents the PCs face, the more actions are on the opponent's side when we're talking about action economy between the player characters and their opponents. And so the more opponents you have, the more actions they have, and it increases the difficulty. So that's why we have these multipliers, or at least that's the theory. So specifically, the multipliers I'm talking about, as soon as you have two monsters, when you're figuring out your XP budget using the system in the DMG to figure out how hard or challenging this encounter will be, as soon as you have two monsters, you multiply that XP times 1.5. When you have 3 to 6 monsters, you multiply by times 2. When you have 7 to 10 monsters, times 2.5. 11 to 14 monsters, times 3. And 15 or more, times 4. So you can see, as soon as you get more than one monster, I mean, it's a pretty substantial difference in your XP budget. So an example to illustrate that the Unearthed Arcana doesn't seem to be doing this, or at least the numbers aren't matching up, is consider hobgoblins, which are CR 1/2. They're worth 100 XP each. So if we are using the Unearthed Arcana encounter building rules and we look at the multiple monsters table, let's assume we have a second level party. So when we look at the multiple monsters table for a second level character, we see that the ratio between a second level PC and a CR 1/2 monster is 1-to-1. Which means one hobgoblin is equal to one second level player character. So let's say you have a party of 4 player characters. Using this table, you would say, okay, it's a 1-to-1 ratio, so I have 4 PCs, so I could throw 4 hobgoblins at them. And again, this is using the medium XP budget, so this should be a medium encounter from the DMG, right? Well, no, because it seems that this is omitting that multiplier for there being more than one monster. So again, using this table from the Unearthed Arcana, we're saying party of 4 second level PCs, 4 CR 1/2 hobgoblins is an appropriate encounter. And to use the exact words that they use in this document, the above guidelines are designed to create a fight that will challenge a party, but which is still winnable. Now, we could probably argue whether we think that that's talking about a hard encounter or a medium encounter from the DMG, but I think we would all agree that it's either hard or medium, definitely not deadly, right? So now let's go to the DMG and look at what this encounter would be using that system. So according to the DMG, a medium encounter for 4 second level characters would have an XP budget of 400 XP. 4 hobgoblins adds up to 400 XP. They're 100 XP each, but you have to use the multiplier because there's 4 of them. Again, the multiplier for 4 NPCs or monsters is x2. So we would actually, for the sake of determining how challenging this encounter is, we would multiply that 400 XP by 2, which gives us 800 XP, which is, drumroll please, a deadly encounter. So, you know, this is just one example. I didn't sit and do every possible permutation of every group size and every challenge rating and every party level. But at least in this one particular example, the math is not adding up because the Unearthed Arcana encounter building is giving us a deadly encounter, which it is claiming is going to be an encounter that will challenge the party but is still winnable. And a deadly encounter in the DMG is described as an encounter that could be lethal for one or more player characters. Survival often requires good tactics and quick thinking, and the party risks defeat. So, you know, maybe they're intentionally giving us deadly encounters in the Unearthed Arcana, and the math is the same, and they're just giving us deadly encounters for some reason. But I think that most of us GMs that are using or trying to use the system in the DMG, we're probably not often shooting for deadly encounters, right? Because it has that word deadly, there's risk of player character death. And, you know, you might make a deadly encounter for like the epic battle at the end of an arc, but you're not going to have a good percentage of your encounters probably be deadly, or at least I wouldn't think so. So this definitely seems to be a discrepancy in the math, and I agree that it appears that this difference is because the method in the Unearthed Arcana is not figuring in those multipliers for having more than one opponent, which leads me to the question of which one is better or correct, or which one is going to work better? The system in the DMG where we're factoring in larger groups and greater action economy on the side of the opposition, and that's factoring into the system, or the method in the Unearthed Arcana, which doesn't seem to factor that in at all. So if you're building encounters using the DMG, you might be building easy encounters, medium encounters, hard encounters, and occasionally deadly encounters. But it seems like, at least using this example with a party of 4 level 2 characters, if you're using the guidelines in the Unearthed Arcana, pretty much most, if not all, of your encounters are going to be deadly. So that's interesting. That definitely seems like a discrepancy to me. I guess it's not so much that the math is different. The math seems to be the same. It's just that one system is factoring in how many opponents are involved and the other system isn't. And it doesn't seem like the two systems can really coexist. It seems like one is going to work really well for you and one isn't. So I think saying that they're the same is a little disingenuous and isn't really true in practice. So even more now, I would really love to hear from any of you who've experimented with using these two different methods. And, you know, especially if you've built encounters using the multiple monsters tables in the Unearthed Arcana, did you find those to be deadly encounters? And, you know, did you have to tone some of them down? Because you don't want to throw all deadly encounters at your PCs all the time, right? What were you finding? And also, for those of you using the guidelines in the DMG, have you maybe found that the medium and hard encounters are too easy and you're using deadly encounters from the DMG? Is it maybe a thing of, since printing the DMG, Wizards has decided that the deadly encounters are where we want to be and the other encounters aren't challenging enough? Could that be it? And I'd love to hear from any of you who've actually used both in your games. What are your feelings as far as the encounters you're getting from each of the methods? You know, does one seem to better fit the difficulty that you need to have? Are they both screwed up? Or what are your thoughts? I'd love to hear from you. All right. I also have a bit of an update for last week's episode, episode 137, specifically when I was talking about the height and weight table. And I was really kind of happy to do that, even though I thought, you know, that's pretty niche and definitely anybody not playing D&D isn't going to care. And even a lot of people playing D&D might not care. But I wanted to talk about that because I think we've had similar tables to that, at least since second edition. I think first edition too. And always people have been confused by those tables. And it seems like every group I've ever been in, there's one or two people in the group that actually understand how to use a table. And everybody else just tends to ignore it because they're confused by it. So I was really happy to take the opportunity to kind of explain how that table works. And not only how you can, you know, use the table to roll dice and generate random height and weight for your character, but also how you can use it to kind of guide you if you want to more choose the height and weight. However, the way that I explained it, I'm afraid that a point I was trying to make maybe didn't come across. So when I was talking about my example of making an elf character and I decided I was going to choose a height for my character of 6 foot, I then, in the example, described making the roll for the weight modifier and then figuring out what I would have rolled for the height and multiplying those together to figure out my weight. And I did it that way to, in fewer words and less time, to both show you how you could choose one of those values and how you could roll for one of those values and how you could even combine the two. But something I should have pointed out, which I want to point out now, is of course you could make choices for both of those. So to go back to my elf example, you know, I decide, you know, my elf is 6 feet tall, which means I would have rolled 18 on the 2d10 for the height modifier. Then instead of rolling the 1d4 to get the weight modifier, I could have chosen a number between 1 and 4. Right? I don't have to roll. I could have chosen. But by choosing a multiplier between 1 and 4 within that 1d4 range, it would ensure the proper relationship of height and weight for an elf. And an easy way to think about that, you know, whether you're rolling 1d4 for your height or your weight, or 2d4 or 1d8 or whatever, think about that possible range, right? So 1d4, you could get a number between 1 and 4. 2d4, you could get a number between 2 and 8, right? So for instance, with the elf, let's say I've chosen my height of 6 foot and I'm thinking about what would this character weigh, and I can roll a 1d4 or I can choose 1, 2, 3, or 4. I would look at it like, okay, if I choose 1, then my character is really thin for an elf of that height, right? If I choose 4, then my character is really thick or heavy for an elf of that height. And another point that I forgot to make is it's a good idea to try to correlate this with your ability scores, right? So if my elf has a really high strength, it would make sense that maybe I would choose a 3 or a 4 for that weight modifier as opposed to a 1 or a 2, because it makes sense that he would be a little heavier for his weight because he's got a high strength. It's assumed he's a bit more muscular, you know, than your average elf. Conversely, if my elf had maybe an average strength or even below average strength, but had a really high dexterity, which sounds right for an elf, right? Then I might choose the 1 or 2 for, you know, that range of 1 to 4 for that weight multiplier, because I'd say, well, he'd be a little thin for his height because, you know, first of all, he's not super strong. And second of all, he's really dexterous. So maybe, you know, he's more thin or whatever. Or if I wanted someone kind of more average, I could choose the 2 or the 3. So, you know, that's something that you can think about, you know, as a player when you're making a character and you're using these height or weight tables. Don't feel like you have to roll, unless I guess your DM tells you have to. But I've never known a DM that was like, you have to roll. You know, most DMs just want you to be within the range of what makes sense, right? So if you're a dwarf, you can't be 7 feet tall. Right. You know, maybe you can be 5 foot something. I don't know. I don't have the table in front of me, you know, and, you know, that table shows you what the range is. Right. So a dwarf, you can look at their starting height And then you can look at their height modifier. And from that, you can figure out what's the shortest that a dwarf would be, what's the tallest that a dwarf would be, what would be the average height of a dwarf. You can easily figure that out from that table. And, you know, hill dwarf and mountain dwarf are going to be different. So that can help you if you want to say, well, my dwarf is uncommonly tall for a dwarf, then you would pick the upper end of that range. Or my dwarf is uncommonly short, or my dwarf is about average height, right? Same thing with weight. Oh, my dwarf is actually pretty heavy for a dwarf, or my dwarf is pretty light for a dwarf, or my dwarf is average. So you can use those to figure out what that would be. So let's say maybe your weight multiplier is 2d4, then 2 would be at the low end of the, you know, the low extreme, 8 would be the high extreme, and your middle would be probably, what would it be, 4, 5, and 6 or something like that. So anyway, probably more detail than most people want about this kind of thing, but I did feel that I didn't quite cover it. And, you know, another point about this kind of thing, you know, that's kind of from a player perspective, like I'm making a character, but this also works as a GM anytime you're facing a table, whether that table is to generate characteristics for an NPC or to generate a dungeon or to generate treasure or to generate ability score, anything. As a GM, you never have to roll dice when you don't want to. You can always just make a decree, right? You don't have to roll to see how tall your NPC is. Your NPC is as tall as you want them to be. You don't necessarily have to accept what you roll for treasure. You could choose something. Now, I would choose something from the same table, so it's the appropriate power level. But, you know, you're not a slave to the dice. Maybe the players are, depending how you run your game. But as a GM, you never are. So anytime you see a table in the game as a GM, never feel like you have to roll dice and do what the dice say. You can always pick something from that table. You can always roll, see what comes up, and if you like it, go with it, and if not, pick something or roll again. That's usually what I do. When I have a table, like let's say I'm rolling for treasure, I will roll the treasure randomly, but anytime I roll up something that I either, like maybe I roll up a magic item I just don't want to deal with because I think it's too powerful or there's rules problems with it, or maybe I roll up an item that I just don't think will be useful. You know, maybe I roll up a potion of water breathing and there's never going to be a chance to breathe underwater in the next few sessions. So I feel like, well, this is a useless item. I don't want to hand this out. Or maybe I just don't like the item that I roll up, or I don't think it's an item that any of the player characters would use. If I don't like what I roll up, I will either just roll again and keep rolling until I roll something I like. Or at that point, I'll just look at the table I'm rolling on and see if something jumps out at me is like, oh yeah, I want to give them a folding boat. Of course, if I'm not going to give them a potion of water breathing, I'm not going to give them a folding boat. That probably wasn't a good example. I'm going to give them a portable hole. I think that would be cool, right? As a GM, look at tables as a source for inspiration. You can roll on the table and use whatever you roll if you like it. Or as is pointed out in, I think, the DMG, you know, even if you roll something on the table and it seems not to fit, or it seems not to make sense, or it seems not to work, or you don't like it, maybe consider using it anyway, because sometimes trying to fit things that don't seem to fit together, you can come up with really interesting ideas that you wouldn't have come up with otherwise. So that's something you can try. Or you can just choose something from the table, or you can use the table as inspiration and come up with your own idea that isn't on the table, but is inspired by the table, or any other method. You know, the tables are just there to help you. They're not your boss. All right, so I just wanted to clear that up about the discussion of the height and weight table in episode 137, and also just kind of tables in general as GMs, and at least how I approach them. And, you know, there's usually not a right or a wrong way. Well, sometimes there's wrong ways to do things when it comes to being a game master, but there's not necessarily a right way or the right way to do it. You know, so if you're someone that you just roll on the table and that's what you get, then that's fine. But don't build barriers or build restrictions around yourself that you don't have to have, right? Keep things open. Keep yourself open to any possibilities that will make for a better story and make your game more fun. Because at the end of the day, that's what's most important.
This is Shane from the Total Party Thrill Podcast, and you're listening to Lex Starwalker on Game Master's Journey.
I want to give a quick shout out to the patrons of Starwalker Studios. The support of the patrons makes this show possible. If you enjoy Game Master's Journey and you'd like to give a little back, becoming a patron is a great way to do so. Patrons get some cool perks like game material I make for Primordia and access to a special monthly podcast I produce just for the patrons. I'd also like to give a huge shout out and thank you to my Tier 4 patron, Mr. Steve Strickland. Let's hear it for Steve. Thank you so much, Steve, and thank you to all the patrons. You can find out more about becoming a patron by clicking on the Patreon button at the top of the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com. All right, so today I am continuing my Let's Read series, and we're still in the Player's Handbook today. So in episode 137, I started at the beginning of the book. We went through the preface and the introduction and chapters 1-4 of the Player's Handbook, but there wasn't a lot that I wanted to discuss in that portion of the book, so we kind of rocketed through it all. Well, today I am just discussing chapter 5, which is all about equipment, and might surprise you. It surprised me that there's so much that I want to talk about in this chapter. When I first started going through it, I was kind of assuming that I would largely skip because I'm like, oh, it's equipmentless and prices. What's there to say about that? But there's actually a lot of gems. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, there are some ways that you can customize your game presented. So let's get into it. So we start out with starting equipment. Now, there are two ways that you can do starting equipment in 5th edition. There's the way that we've always done it, and then there's the way, the new way, that is actually the way I prefer, being a grognard as I am. I like the new way better. The new way is when you're making your character, in your character class, you will have equipment packages, and there will be a few different ones, and you get to pick one of those packages. So usually you'll get a weapon or two, some kind of armor if you can wear armor, and some kind of equipment pack or some miscellaneous stuff. Then you also will get some additional equipment from your background. And that will usually be a little bit of money and then things like tools or kits or things like those. So that's kind of the 5th edition way to do starting equipment, which is what I prefer because it gives you, as a first level character, it gives you the stuff that you need to start out, and you don't have to like go shopping. You have it there, and it's really great for newer players because kind of the basics are covered and they have a little money left over that they can spend during play. Now, the optional way that you can do it, which is what's presented here in this table, starting wealth by class, is the way that we've done it in previous editions, which is where each class has a different role they make that determines how much money you start out with, and then you use that money to buy all your starting equipment. So for instance, the fighter rolls 5d4 and then multiplies that by 10 gold pieces. 5d4 times 10 gold pieces. Fighter has that much money to buy weapon, armor, food, just anything and everything that your character might have. You start with nothing, use that gold to buy what you need. So despite me being a grognard from all the way back to first edition, and this being the way we always did it back in the day, I like the new way better. First of all, the new way is simpler, easier, especially for new players, and it takes less time. Even the most greenhorn player, it's going to take some time to roll up your gold. Well, that doesn't take that much time, but to go through the equipment charts and figure out what you can afford and what you want to get, where, you know, the equipment that comes from your class and your profession, you know, it's just like, boom, there it is. Now, I will point out here that it's an either-or thing. You don't get your equipment from your class and your profession and the starting gold here. You do one or the other. You either give the player characters equipment from their class and profession, or they roll for their starting gold and they buy stuff a la carte from the equipment tables. And I have looked, and it seems like you get more bang for your buck with the new method too. You know, I've looked at some of the starting equipments for various characters and whatnot, and compared what it would cost to buy the equipment given by the class and profession compared to what I could have rolled and what, you know, and it turns out you tend to get more money's worth of equipment taking the starting equipment that's given to you as opposed to rolling for it and buying it, even if you roll well. But this is a way to customize your game right here. You know, it's a pretty small thing, but starting equipment, you know, do you want to just let your player characters choose one of the options from their class and then they get some stuff from their profession and boom, you're ready to go? Or would you rather they roll for gold and then they have to buy stuff? And I don't think there's anything wrong with having a mix within the group. Again, you don't want a given character using both methods, but you could have player A take the equipment from their class and profession and player B rolls for gold and spends it. It may not be exactly equal, but it's not going to be a big enough difference to matter. And I mean, starting equipment isn't that big of a deal anyway. Oftentimes, you can't even afford to buy the weapon and the armor that you want. So you don't have to worry about players buying a bunch of healing potions or anything like that. Because, healing potions are like 50 gold. And if you buy one healing potion at level one for your starting equipment, you're probably not going to be able to buy a whole lot else. And that's another thing I will point out. In 5th edition, the standard healing potion is a common item. It is on the equipment tables in the player's handbook, and the intent is that player characters can buy those, you know, kind of from, not necessarily from anywhere, but, you know, if you're doing your starting equipment, you should let your player characters buy healing potions for 50 gold if they want. That's the intent of the game. That's why it's on the equipment tables in the player's handbook, because that's something players should have access to. Same thing with Potion of Climbing, I think, is in there as well. Tables in the DMG, the other magic items in the game are in the DMG because, you know, players shouldn't just assume that they can just go and buy those anywhere because they can't. Stuff in the player's handbook, they should have access to, unless you have a really good reason to do otherwise. All right. So then we get into wealth. Let's see. Starting equipment. I have a list here of things I want to talk about. Okay. So wealth, coinage, we're not going to discuss. Now, there's some interesting things here on page 144 on selling treasure. Opportunities abound to find treasure, equipment, weapons, armor, and more in the dungeons you explore. Normally, you can sell your treasures and trinkets when you return to a town or other settlement, provided that you can find buyers and merchants interested in your loot. And then we have some discussion of some different categories of things that player characters might want to sell. So first, we've got arms, armor, and other equipment. As a general rule, undamaged, keyword there, weapons, armor, and other equipment fetch half their cost when sold in a market. Weapons and armor used by monsters are rarely in good enough condition to sell. So no, you know, your player characters can't take the short sword from every goblin they kill and go and sell it for half the price of a short sword on the equipment table. It's assumed that that goblin short sword is a piece of crap, it's dull, it's rusted, it's bent, who knows, but it's not in good enough condition that anybody's going to pay money for it. Magic items. Selling magic items is problematic. Finding someone to buy a potion or a scroll isn't too hard, but other items are out of the realm of most but the wealthiest nobles. Likewise, aside from a few common magic items, you won't normally come across magic items or spells to purchase. So see here that they are saying aside from a few common magic items, which includes potions of healing. So those are exceptions to the general rule that you can't find magic items for sale. Those are exceptions. Again, you're the DM. You can do it differently, but think about what you're doing and have a good reason to do it differently. Don't do it differently just to do it differently or just to screw your players because you don't want them to have any healing potions. The value of magic is far beyond simple gold and should always be treated as such. Next, we have gems, jewelry, and art objects. These items retain their full value in the marketplace. I see a lot of GMs screwing players on this one. Gems, jewelry, art objects retain full value in the marketplace, and you can either trade them in for coin or use them as currency for other transactions. So, you know, this is cool too. You know, if you're going to buy a suit of plate armor for 1500 gold, yeah, you can hand over 1,500 gold pieces, or you could maybe hand over a few gems worth 500 gold a piece, or a piece of art worth a bunch of money. You know, this is not saying that every merchant is going to take every form of payment, but it's saying that, you know, you should think about this, and it should be fairly easy to convert gems, jewelry, and art objects into money, or to use them to purchase things. You know, keep in mind that, you know, in these societies that we game in, you know, usually things are actually often done through barter. And, you know, with the exception of some nobles, merchants, and adventurers, most people aren't buying things with actual coins. They're trading good, you know, one good for another good or something like this. So a player character wanting to buy something using gems or jewelry or an art object or even trade goods, which they talk about later, like a bag of salt or some flour, is not at all unusual, and they should be able to do that. Another kind of element you can pull in here that I often use is the idea of money changers. So the classic example of this is player characters are adventuring and find thousands upon thousands of copper pieces. Nobody wants to carry around thousands upon thousands of copper pieces. They'd much rather trade those in for their equivalent in gold pieces or even platinum pieces and have a lot less coins and weight to worry about, right? And there are people in the world who make a living changing currency from one form to another, but they make their living doing that, right? So it costs you something. I usually say just 10%. So if you're going to take 100,000 copper pieces to some money changer and trade it in for gold, let's say 100,000 copper pieces would be 1,000 gold, right? It's 100-to-1 ratio. 10% of 1,000 is 100. So you would hand in your 100,000 copper pieces and you would get 900 gold back. You should get 1,000 gold, but the money changer is keeping 100 gold for his fee. So using these trade goods and art objects and gems for transactions to buy things can be a way that player characters can avoid those fees of making change, basically. Now, just like in the real world, you know, you can't go buy a car with pennies. You know, merchants aren't going to take thousands upon thousands of copper pieces. So player characters aren't going to be able to unload their copper in that way. I mean, you can spend copper, you know, buying something from a peasant or giving some money to a beggar, but that's about the limit of what you can do with copper. You know, you're not going to be able to buy something that costs silver or gold or more with copper pieces. So either, you know, player characters are either going to be leaving all that copper behind in the dungeon and they just don't even take it, which I've seen players do that, or they're going to end up with tons and tons of copper that they can't really sell. And eventually they're, you know, going to have to change it into something else or just write it off. So that's something interesting to think about that can kind of bring more of a logistical aspect into the game. Some people really get into that some kind of stuff. Some people don't. So you may want to hand wave it. I know GMs who just don't give out copper pieces. So they just either ignore the copper part of a treasure or they'll convert it to silver or gold or something like that. Me, I like to give out the copper because I think it's realistic. I think about, and we'll talk about this way in the future when we get to the treasure chapter of the DMG, but you know, when I roll treasure, especially the monetary stuff, it doesn't necessarily take the form that I roll up. So I may roll 3,000 copper and decide in this particular treasure, there wouldn't really be any copper. So instead of 3,000 copper, I'm going to say it's 300 silver or 30 gold. There might be another treasure where I'd say, oh, it's all going to be in copper for some reason. So even though I'm rolling gold and silver and art objects and all this stuff, I'm going to translate it all into its value in copper. And you find 1,000,000 copper pieces. Woo! And part of that is, do I think it'll be fun or interesting to give the player characters this dilemma of, hey, we just found a decent amount of money, but it's in the form of copper and it's a lot of weight and volume that we have to get out of here somehow. And it's going to actually be an expedition just to get the treasure out of here. You know, sometimes that can be fun and interesting, and sometimes it can just be annoying. So, you know, you have to decide case by case what you want to do. But yeah, just things to think about. For exceptionally valuable treasures, so maybe a piece of art worth thousands of gold, the DM might require you to find a buyer in a large town or larger community first, which just makes sense, right? You're not going to find someone to buy your 300,000 gold piece painting in a village, most likely. Next, we have trade goods. On the borderlands, many people conduct transactions through barter, and I would say any place that isn't a a city, most people conduct by barter. And even in a city, most of the lower class people are still using barter. Like gems and art objects, trade goods, bars of iron, bags of salt, livestock, and so on, retain their full value in the market and can be used as currency. So one other thing I will just mention here while we're talking about money and stuff, and again, we're going to hit this in more detail in the DMG, but there is a section on the DMG about currency, and it talks about trade bars. And trade bars are bars of metal, so bars of gold or silver, platinum, electrum, whatever, that are usually a pound or more in weight. So just like in the real world, we have gold bars and silver bars and troy ounces and stuff like that. Same kind of thing. And that can be a great way if you want to have a treasure that's worth a lot of money, but maybe it's a merchant's vault or a bank or something like that, where it doesn't make sense that they just have bags and bags of copper pieces or even gold pieces. You know, trade bars can be a great way to handle large amounts of money, because a platinum trade bar is worth a lot of gold, but it's just one thing to carry around. And trade bars would be another thing that, just like art objects, gems, jewelry, and trade goods, they're their market value. There's no loss of value when you trade them or buy or sell them. There's also a little sidebar on page 144 that I want to talk about. Here's our first variant that we're talking about in this series, and this variant is equipment sizes. So every time you see one of these variants, whether it's in the player's handbook or the DMG, and you're running the game, you're the DM, you get to decide, do I want to use this variant or not? And oftentimes, just looking at these variants will raise questions that you would have never thought of. Like, for instance, this one on equipment sizes. So let's see what it says. In most campaigns, you can use or wear any equipment that you find on your adventures within the bounds of common sense. For example, a burly half-orc won't fit in a halfling's leather armor, and a gnome would be swallowed up in a cloud giant's elegant robe. So just common sense, right? The DM can impose more realism. For example, a suit of plate armor made for one human might not fit another one without significant alterations. And a guard's uniform might be visibly ill-fitting when an adventurer tries to wear it as a disguise. Using this variant, when adventurers find armor, clothing, and similar items that are made to be worn, they might need to visit an armorsmith, tailor, leather worker, or similar expert to make the item wearable. The cost for such work varies from 10 to 40% of the market price of the item. The DM can either roll 1d4 times 10 to figure out this percentage, or determine the increase in costs based on the extent of the alterations required. So this is interesting to think about, and we're going to have a similar variant in the DMG when we start talking about magical armor and things like that. But, you know, this is something to think about. And again, you know, different GMs do it different ways, and sometimes GMs will do it different ways in different adventures or different campaigns, depending on, you know, it's kind of a balance between realism and how fiddly is your mechanics of your system getting, you know, and we all kind of have a different place on that spectrum where we feel most comfortable. Me, I tend to veer more towards more realistic, even if it means a little bit more mechanics to deal with, because things that are really unrealistic just kick me out of the story, you know. And it's one thing to say that you find this super magical chain shirt that will resize itself to fit anything from a halfling to a half-orc. But it's something else to say something like a mundane suit of plate armor can be worn by anybody. Especially since I know that in the real world, you know, full plate armor was custom made and fitted to an individual. And you couldn't even just have two human men wear the same armor unless they were, you know, pretty much exactly the same size, because even two men that are the same height and the same weight aren't necessarily going to have the same dimensions, right? You go to a tailor, they measure everything. They don't just measure how tall you are, right? How deep is your chest? How wide are your shoulders? How wide are your hips? You know, all this stuff goes into fitting something like that. So me, I like this variant and I will often use this and say, you know, hey, you find this awesome suit of armor, but before you can wear it, you need to go to an armor smith and have them fit it to you. And then again, you know, you can have that cost be anywhere from 10 to 40% of the market price. So if we're talking full plate armor, off the top of my head, I think the market price for full plate is 1500 gold. So 10% would be 150 gold. 40% would be four times that, which is like 600 gold, I think. So, you know, for those of you that don't think there's enough for players to spend their gold on, here you go. Here's a way to have them spend more gold is every time they find a suit of armor, if they have to get it fitted, you know, that'll add up, especially at low levels. But I like the realism of that. But, you know, you may not like having to deal with, you know, oh, the player characters are in the middle of a dungeon. They found armor, but they can't actually use it until they go back to town and have an armorer size it to them. And then, you know, that's going to take time. You know, it may take a few days or even longer because maybe he's got other jobs he's got to do first. You know, you might want him to be able to just put that armor on in the middle of the dungeon. So, you know, you can make a decision here just, you know, across the board, but you can also make exceptions, right? So maybe I decide that I really like the realism of, no, you have to get armor fitted. But in a particular game session, the player characters find some armor in a dungeon and they really need it and I want them to have it. I could just say, well, in this particular instance, it just so happens that the guy who this armor was made for is close enough to your size that it can work. And I could just say it just fits you and you don't need to worry about it. Or I could say, you know, it fits you and you can use it, but it's very uncomfortable because it doesn't fit you quite right. So, you know, maybe there's a penalty for that or maybe there's not. Maybe it's just a role-playing thing and it's like, hey, the first chance you get, you're going to want to resize this armor so it's more comfortable. And it's purely role-playing. Or I could do something like you don't get quite the full armor class bonus, or you have a disadvantage on stealth or something like that because it doesn't fit well, or maybe it reduces your movement by 5 feet, or maybe if you wear it for more than so many hours at a time, you start suffering from exhaustion because it doesn't fit well. I mean, there's a lot of ways that you could mechanically reflect the fact that this armor doesn't quite fit right, but it's still close enough that they can use it. So, you know, keep that in mind. You know, you can make these general rules, again, specific beats general, even in your house rules. So you can make these general rules, but you can always find ways to come up with exceptions if you need to in the moment. So now we start going into descriptions of different types of armor. The one thing I want to call out here is armor proficiency and what happens if you're not proficient in armor. In 5th edition, you can actually wear armor you're not proficient in. Previous editions of the game had rules like, you know, wizards can't wear armor of any kind, and if they put on armor, they can't cast spells, stuff like that. The way it works in 5th edition is anyone can put on a suit of armor or strap a shield to an arm. Only those proficient in the armor's use know how to wear it effectively, however. Your class gives you proficiency with certain types of armor. If you wear armor that you lack proficiency with, you have disadvantage on any ability check, saving throw, or attack roll that involves strength or dexterity, and you can't cast spells. All right, so if you're a wizard, you're not proficient in armor, you can wear it. You can get the armor class bonus, but you're going to be disadvantaged at any ability check, saving throw, or attack roll that uses strength or dex, and you can't cast spells. So you might be like, well, that's the same as before, Lex. They're just saying it differently. And you're right, but the big difference is that a wizard can get proficiency in armor some way by multiclassing into another class, maybe, or by taking a feat. Actually, I don't know if you'd get proficiency in armor multiclassing. Multiclassing is its own thing that we'll get into maybe later. Or actually, I think we're going to skip it. I don't know. Let me know. Do you want to hear about multiclassing or not? All right. So anyway, so obviously there's pretty huge drawbacks for using armor that you're not proficient in. You're not going to be doing very well at any roles involving strength or dexterity. So you're not going to be doing very well in any kind of combat. You can't cast spells, but it's possible. And again, you know, if you somehow become proficient in that armor, then you're fine. So if you're a wizard and you take a feat that gives you proficiency in armor and you wear armor, then you're good to go. You can cast spells just fine. There's no chance of spell failure or anything like that. So yeah, that's about it that I'm going to discuss here on armor. Next, we go into weapons and descriptions of weapons. Oh, wait, here's one other thing to mention about armor. This is something that's often overlooked. On page 146, getting into and out of armor. You can't just put on or take off armor as an action. I see people do that a lot. It doesn't work that way. The time it takes to don or doff armor depends on the armor's category. Don. This is the time it takes to put on armor. You benefit from the armor's armor class only if you take the full time to don the suit of armor. Doff is the time it takes to take off the armor. These are really old, obscure words they're using here, but whatever. If you have help, reduce this time by half. All right, so light armor, this just goes by category. Light armor takes you a minute to put light armor on. 1 minute, that's 10 rounds, people. To take it off takes a minute. If you have someone helping you, half that, so 30 seconds, which is 5 rounds. Medium armor, 5 minutes, 50 rounds. take it off 1 minute, or again 30 seconds if someone's helping you. Heavy armor, 10 minutes to put it on. 5 minutes to take it off, 2.5 minutes if someone helps you. A shield, this is a big one, guys. takes one action to put a shield on your arm. So it takes a full action just to strap the shield on. And until you spend that full action, you don't get the bonus to armor class. So, you know, all those fighters wearing their shield on their back so they can use two weapons or use a two-handed weapon, and they want to switch in the middle of a fight, remembering also, you know, how long it takes to change weapons and all that good stuff, it also takes a full action just to strap that shield onto your arm. It also takes an action to remove the shield. Now, they say if someone helps you, it takes half the time. I don't know what half an action it would be. So I think we can ignore someone helping you to remove a shield. Unless in a specific situation, you wanted to get really granular for some reason, or it was really important, maybe someone helped, you could say they could do it as a bonus action. Maybe. I don't know. That'd be up to you. That'd definitely be a house rule. All right. So weapon proficiency is another thing I wanted to discuss from this page. So there are two categories of weapons, simple and martial. Most people can use simple weapons with proficiency. So again, that's a general rule. So unless you have something that tells you you can't use simple weapons, you can. These weapons include clubs, maces, and other weapons often found in the hands of commoners. Martial weapons, including swords, axes, and pole arms, require more specialized training to use effectively. Most warriors use martial weapons because these weapons put their fighting style and training to best use. Proficiency with a weapon allows you to add your proficiency bonus to the attack roll for any attack you make with that weapon. If you make an attack roll using a weapon with which you lack proficiency, you do not add your proficiency bonus to the attack roll. So if you're someone that just has proficiency with simple weapons and you want to use a martial weapon like a longsword, you'd just be adding that strength bonus to hit. You wouldn't be adding your proficiency bonus. It's just that simple. Some other notable sections in this chapter is the discussion of improvised weapons on page 147. This is something that can be overlooked and is actually really useful mechanic to have under your belt as a DM, because there'll be lots of times that you can use these improvised weapons rules. Sometimes characters don't have their weapons and have to attack with whatever is close at hand. An improvised weapon includes any object you can wield in one or two hands, such as broken glass, a table leg, a frying pan, a wagon wheel, or a dead goblin. In many cases, an improvised weapon is similar to an actual weapon and can be treated as such. For example, a table leg, is akin to a club. At the DM's option, a character proficient with a weapon can use a similar object as if it were that weapon and use his or her proficiency bonus. So it's just saying, again, it's up to you as a DM, but if a character wants to use something as an improvised weapon and you think it's close enough to an actual weapon that it could be considered the same, and if they're proficient in that weapon, then they can be considered proficient in that improvised weapon. So the table leg example, you could say that's close enough to a club that if you're proficient in club, which is a simple weapon, so most people are proficient in it, then you can be proficient in using a table leg. You can use that as a weapon and use your proficiency bonus when you roll to hit. Otherwise, you don't get that bonus. An object that bears no resemblance to a weapon deals 1d4 damage. So again, the table leg, you know, if I wanted to know, well, how much damage would that do? I would just look to the weapon that it's similar to. So I'd say it does the damage of a club. But if we're talking about a broken bottle, well, that's not really similar enough to a dagger to say it does the same damage. So we'll say it does the improvised weapon damage, which is 1d4, which I guess happens to be the same as a dagger, but you know where I'm going here. And then the DM assigns a damage type appropriate to the weapon. So if you're going to hit someone over the head with a rock, it'd be 1d4 bludgeoning. If you're going to stab them with a broken bottle, it'd be 1d4 piercing or slashing, depending how the player character describes the attack. A stabbing attack would be piercing. A slashing attack would be slashing. If a character uses a ranged weapon to make a melee attack or throws a melee weapon that does not have the thrown property, it also deals 1d4 damage. An improvised thrown weapon has a normal range of 20 feet and a long range of 60 feet. So this little section here, pages 147 and 148 on improvised weapons, is invaluable and can be used to cover so many things that come up in the game that seem not to be covered by the rules, but they are by this handy dandy little rule here. Also, I have a section here on silvered weapons. So there are monsters in the game that have resistance to damage from normal slashing, piercing, and bludgeoning weapons. You can overcome that resistance with magic, usually. So, you know, if your weapon's magic, you're good to go. But then some creatures will have a vulnerability to silver in that if your weapon is silver, it will overcome that damage reduction. So lycanthropes are an example of monsters that are like that. So you can silver a single weapon or 10 pieces of ammunition for 100 gold. So if a player character asks you, how much does it cost to put silver plating on my sword so I can fight werewolves? There you go, 100 gold. This cost represents not only the price of the silver, but the time and expertise needed to add silver to the weapon without making it less effective. And actually, in real world, silver weapons are not very effective weapons. So I think that's fair.
One of my favorite things about producing this show is when I hear from listeners like you. If you have any feedback on this or any episode of Game Master's Journey, whether that's a comment, a question, or a request for a future topic, there are a lot of great ways that you can get a hold of me. Head on over to the website at starwalkerstudios.com/GameMastersJourney, and there you can email me, you can find my Twitter, Google+, Facebook, Pinterest, YouTube information, and more. You can also find a link to the Game Master's Journey community where you can share ideas with other listener GMs. Finally, you can learn about how you can support the show by becoming a patron or making a one-time donation. You can find all of this and more at starwalkerstudios.com.
All right, so now we go into adventuring gear. We've got tables with prices and weights. And on page 151, we have the equipment packs. So if you're using the standard equipment given by the classes, oftentimes it will include one of these packs. And this tells you what is in each of the packs and also what it would cost to buy the pack itself. For people that are rolling for treasure, for people that are rolling for starting gold, or for characters that want to buy one later. And those packs are the Burglar's Pack, Diplomat's Pack, Dungeoneer's Pack, Entertainer's Pack, Explorer's Pack, Priest Pack, Scholar's Pack. And this is one of the reasons that I think that the given equipment in the classes is actually a little bit better than rolling for equipment. Because if you add up the value of the individual items in the packs, often the price of the pack itself is less than if you bought everything piecemeal. But I guess if you roll for gold, you could still buy one of these packs. So I guess if you're rolling for treasure and you're going to buy one of these or get the things that's in one of them, you're better off getting the pack than buying the things individually. Of course, most of these packs are probably going to have a couple things that you don't want, so if you want to crunch the numbers and see if it's worth, you know, buying the things individually that you want and ignoring the ones you don't, or just buying the pack, Go for it. Another interesting tidbit in this chapter is on page 153, container capacity. You know, sometimes like this stuff comes up in game. How much can I fit in my backpack or my belt pouch or this sack that I'm carrying or my water skin, right? So this has a bunch of common containers and tells you how much they can hold. So for instance, the backpack capacity is 1 cubic foot or 30 pounds of gear. Also has a note that says you can also strap items such as a bedroll or a coil of rope to the outside of a backpack. A pouch holds 1/5 cubic foot or about 6 pounds of gear. Sack, 1 cubic foot or about 30 pounds of gear. It's got vial, water skin, jug or pitcher, flask or tankard, chest, bucket, bottle, basket, barrel. So there you go. If that ever comes up, it's in the equipment chapter in the player's handbook. You can find all that. All right, next we have a section on tools. This is something that's a little bit different in this edition. A tool helps you do something you couldn't otherwise do, such as craft or repair an item, forge a document, or pick a lock. Your race, class, background, or feats give you proficiency with certain tools. Proficiency with a tool allows you to add your proficiency bonus to any ability check you make using that tool. Tool use is not tied to a single ability, since proficiency with a tool represents broader knowledge of its use. For example, the DM might ask you to make a dexterity check to carve a fine detail with your woodcarver's tools, or a strength check to make something out of particularly hard wood. But again, you'd be using a tool that you're proficient in, so you would add your proficiency bonus to that check regardless of whether it was strength or dexterity. Probably the most common tool you see used in the game are the thieves' tools. So, you know, if you have a thief PC and he wants to pick a lock, that's a dexterity check to pick that lock, but he has to use thieves' tools to do it. He can't pick a lock without thieves' tools. And since he's proficient in those thieves' tools, he gets to add his proficiency bonus to the dexterity check. Now, it's six of one, half a dozen of the other, but the way I tend to think of this is I just think of tools as additional skills, but they're skills that aren't directly tied to a specific ability. So for instance, stealth is tied to dexterity. Now you can use stealth with other ability scores, and we'll talk about that. But normally stealth is a dexterity skill, where thieves' tools is just thieves' tools. It's not necessarily a dexterity tool. It could be any of the attributes. But I think of the tools as just other skills. So a thief using a set of thieves' tools, well, he's proficient in them, so it's a dexterity with proficiency bonus, or the same as using any dexterity skill that you're proficient in. Now, you might say, well, wouldn't thieves' tools always be dexterity? And, well, not necessarily. Thieves' tools are also used to disable traps. And depending on the nature of the trap and the situation, you might say that that is an intelligence roll using thieves' tools instead of dexterity. Or maybe even something else. Maybe you feel like there's a lot of perception involved in disabling this trap, and it's not so much about, can you figure it out? It's not so much about how nimble are you. It's, do you hear that soft little click that you need to hear to know when to do the thing? So maybe you'd say it's a wisdom check using thieves' tools. And that's one of the things I love about the system, is the flexibility of how you can use different abilities or different attributes like strength, dexterity, etc., with different skills and with different tools, so that, you know, not every role is exactly the same. And you can also represent those kind of corner cases where it's like, yeah, I definitely am using my thieves' tools, but it seems like I'm more using intelligence than dexterity. Or yeah, I'm trying to be sneaky, but it's more about, you know, being aware of my surroundings, so I'm more using wisdom than dexterity, or, you know, any example you can think of. Next, we have a section on mounts and vehicles. So here's where to go if, you know, the PCs want to acquire mounts or vehicles. You can find out how much they cost, how fast they move, how much weight they can carry, all kinds of good stuff. Here also, we have our section on trade goods that I mentioned briefly before. So these things are things like wheat, flour, salt, iron, copper, ginger, cinnamon, clove, silver, silk, saffron, gold, platinum. So when we're talking gold and platinum, we're talking about, you know, raw elements, not coins. And finally, we have a section on expenses. So, you know, there's different ways that you can handle this. You can just ignore it and just not worry about how or if the player characters are paying for their room and board and food and drink and repairs on their equipment and stuff like that. So you could just ignore it. You can get very granular and, you know, get into accounting and track every copper piece every time a PC, you know, tips the serving girl or buys a flask of ale or whatever, you know, every little thing, keep track of it that way. Or you can use the lifestyle expenses, which I'm a pretty big fan of these lifestyle expenses. This is a nice way to still have the cost of living have an impact on the game and a way to kind of divert some of the money coming into the player's hands out of it again without getting too much mired in bookkeeping. Lifestyle expenses provide you with a simple way to account for the cost of living in a fantasy world. They cover your accommodations, food and drink, and all your other necessities. Furthermore, expenses cover the cost of maintaining your equipment so you can be ready when an adventure next calls. At the start of each week or month, your choice, choose a lifestyle from the expenses table and pay the price to sustain that lifestyle. The prices listed are per day, so if you wish to calculate the cost of your chosen lifestyle over a 30-day period, multiply the listed price by 30. I tend to do this by the week personally, and I'll tell you why. I use the 10-day week in my games, which I actually got that from Forgotten Realms, just because it's a nice round number. And so I use 10 days as weeks in my game already. So my weeks are 10 days long, not 7 in Primordia. So conveniently, our units of coin in the game are in increments of 10, right? So 10 copper equals 1 silver, 10 silver equals 1 gold, 10 gold equals 1 platinum. So when I look at a cost of living per day, to convert it to per week, I can either just add a zero. So for instance, a modest lifestyle is 1 gold piece per day. So if I want to know that per week, I could just add a zero and that gives me 10 gold pieces. Or I could just move the coin up one rank. And we got to ignore Electrum in this because Electrum doesn't fit the 1 to 10 ratio because an Electrum is half of a gold piece or 5 silver pieces. So 1 gold piece, if I move that up one rank, becomes 1 platinum piece, which is 10 gold. So it's 6 of one, half a dozen of the other. It's however you want to think of it. I tend to just add the zero and say 10 gold. But that's how I do it because it's really easy. You know, I mean, not that multiplying by 30 is that hard, but I just find it easier, you know, once a week in game to say, okay, everybody pay your expenses for the week. And then you just times that number by 10 and that's how much you pay. It's easy peasy. Your lifestyle might change from one period to the next based on the funds you have at your disposal, or you might maintain the same lifestyle throughout your character's career. And that's another nice thing about doing it by the week is it gives you more opportunities to change that lifestyle without getting to doing it every single day, which might be a bit much. Your lifestyle choice can have consequences. Maintaining a wealthy lifestyle might help you make contacts with the rich and powerful, though you run the risk of attracting thieves. And this is something I really like to do in game. You know, if I have a character who's consistently maintaining a wealthy lifestyle, they're more likely to get robbed. Right. But if they ever want to, you know, rub elbows with the upper crust of society, they're going to have an easier job doing that because not only are they at that moment appearing to be in that social caste, but they've consistently presented themselves away for, you know, a period of time in the past. So they have this reputation of being rich. Likewise, living frugally might help you avoid criminals, but you are unlikely to make powerful connections. And something I'm really looking forward to in exploring in my world of Primordia is really getting into social classes, which is something that isn't quite there in the core of the game. This idea of, you know, are you a peasant? Are you a merchant or an artisan, kind of the middle class, or are you a noble? And, you know, I would say if a player character is a noble, I would require them to uphold a certain level of lifestyle overall. I mean, they could have a bad week or whatever, but overall to uphold a certain level of lifestyle, or it could cause them problems because, you know, if this player character is of noble birth, but he's living a squalid lifestyle, people are going to start not respecting him and he could even lose his title or people don't believe he's who he says he is. So we have a chart that gives the price per day for different lifestyles, all the way from wretched, which has no price per day, all the way up to aristocratic, which is a 10 gold minimum per day, but you can go more than that. I have a player that I've played with online, Steve, who is also the Steve you hear about in almost every episode because he's a tier 4 patron. And Steve's character, Serenity, was very aristocratic. She was actually of royal birth. And so he always paid well above the 10 gold minimum for that aristocratic lifestyle, which, you know, was a pretty big money sink for him, but was really awesome role playing. And I really appreciated, you know, that level of being true to his character, even though it kind of made things maybe more difficult for him. Although I never recall him really being hurting for money. But yeah, really cool RP opportunities and all this stuff. In case you're wondering, why would we worry about this? This is why I worry about it. I'm not so much worried about taxing my players or sucking away their hard-earned gold. Because honestly, if I want to make them more poor, there's countless ways I could do it, right? For me, I'm always looking for opportunities for good role-playing, good story, and character development. And that kind of stuff can come about when you start thinking about, you know, how is my character living day to day? And maybe it differs within the group. So maybe one character is living on the streets, dressed in rags, you know, filthy, and the other characters live in like a noble, you know, smelling of perfume soaps and oils and immaculately clean all the time. Well, right there's a source of conflict within the group that has nothing to do with character class or alignment or anything that really has a statistic in the game other than how you're spending your money. And it could be a really interesting way to develop character through time. So here's some descriptions of those different lifestyles. Starting out with wretched at the bottom. You live in inhumane conditions. With no place to call home, you shelter wherever you can, sneaking into barns, huddling in old crates, and relying on the good graces of people better off than you. A wretched lifestyle presents abundant dangers. Violence, disease, and hunger follow you wherever you go. Other wretched people covet your armor, weapons, and adventuring gear, which represents a fortune by their standards. You are beneath the notice of most people. So you see here, you know, you might have your min-maxing player who says, you know, you start doing this lifestyle thing, and they're like, well, I'm going to be wretched because I don't have to pay any money. But there's drawbacks, right? You know, they're more likely to get sick. They're more likely to have some kind of health problems. And they're more likely to be robbed by other people of their station because, well, they've got shiny weapons and stuff that these other people don't have. So there's pros and cons to all of these, I think, which is another kind of interesting element. Next, we have squalid. You live in a leaky stable, a mud-floored hut just outside town, or a vermin-infested boarding house in the worst part of town. You have shelter from the elements, but you live in a desperate and often violent environment, in places rife with disease, hunger, and misfortune. You are beneath the notice of most people, and you have few legal protections. Most people at this lifestyle level have suffered some terrible setback. They might be disturbed, marked as exiles, or suffer from disease. So right now, you know, looking at these things, I just had a thought that this would be a great way to think about setting up my social classes in my city of Alondria, which is something I've been wanting to do, is I could look at these different lifestyles and think, you know, which of these would fit in which class. So, you know, at the minimum, I'm going to have like a peasant class and then a middle class, which is your artisans and your merchants, and then the nobles, and then maybe above them, you know, the upper crust of the nobles, like the royal family and stuff like that. So I could say, you know, well, the peasants, you know, are wretched, squalid, or poor, and the middle class is modest, comfortable, and wealthy. And then the nobles are wealthy and aristocratic or whatever. And so you can kind of use this as world building fodder too, to kind of think about, you know, where would people of these different lifestyles be located in my city? What would they be like? You know, are there parts of the city where all the wretched people are, like your slums? You know, so you can kind of use this to spur on some ideas for world building too, which is kind of cool. So we'll go on to poor. A poor lifestyle means going without the comforts available in a stable community. Simple food and lodgings, threadbare clothing, and unpredictable conditions result in a sufficient, though probably unpleasant, experience. Your accommodations might be a room in a flop house or in the common room above a tavern. You benefit from some legal protections, but you still have to contend with violence, crime, and disease. People at this lifestyle level tend to be unskilled laborers, costermongers, peddlers, thieves, mercenaries, and other disreputable types. So right here, you know, just that, the fact that people at this level tend to be disreputable, you know, I could see, you know, if you're having a poor or lower lifestyle and you're interacting with someone of a higher lifestyle, I could see this imposing disadvantage on social roles because they just assume that you're trouble. Next, we have modest. A modest lifestyle keeps you out of the slums and ensures that you can maintain your equipment. So this, I think, would be the minimum for most PCs. You know, unless you're really wanting to play a down-and-out character, modest is probably where you want to start because your lifestyle is not going to get in the way of being an adventurer. You live in an older part of town, renting a room in a boarding house, inn, or temple. You don't go hungry or thirsty, and your living conditions are clean if simple. Ordinary people living modest lifestyles include soldiers with families, laborers, students, priests, hedge wizards, and the like. Next, we have comfortable. Choosing a comfortable lifestyle means that you can afford nicer clothing and can easily maintain your equipment. You live in a small cottage, in a middle-class neighborhood, or in a private room at a fine inn. You associate with merchants, skilled tradespeople, and military officers. Next, we have wealthy. Oh, and just let me tell you, in case someone isn't looking at the book, the squalid lifestyle was a silver per day. The poor lifestyle was 2 silver a day. Modest was a gold per day. Comfortable, which is what we just talked about, was 2 gold a day per day. And now wealthy is 4 gold a day. And wealthy is choosing a wealthy lifestyle means living a life of luxury, though you might not have achieved the social status associated with the old money of nobility or royalty. You live a lifestyle comparable to that of a highly successful merchant, a favored servant of the royalty, or the owner of a few small businesses. You have respectable lodgings, usually a spacious home in a good part of town, or a comfortable suite at a fine inn. You likely have a small staff of servants. And then finally, we have aristocratic. And again, aristocratic is 10 or more gold per day. You live a life of plenty and comfort. You move in circles populated by the most powerful people in the community. You have excellent lodgings, perhaps a townhouse in the nicest part of town or rooms in the finest inn. You dine at the best restaurants, retain the most skilled and fashionable tailor, and have servants attending to your every need. You receive invitations to the social gatherings of the rich and powerful and spend evenings in the company of politicians, guild leaders, high priests, and nobility. You must also contend with the highest levels of deceit and treachery. The wealthier you are, the greater the chance you will be drawn into political intrigue as a pawn or participant. So right here in Aristocratic, you see all kinds of story seeds here, right? And plot hooks that we could use. You receive invitations to social gatherings of the rich and powerful. You know, right there's something a GM could use as a hook to a whole adventure. You know, you've got an aristocratic person in the party and they get invited to a dinner or a meeting or something that leads to something interesting. Also, the wealthier you are, the greater the chance you will be drawn into political intrigue as a pawn or participant. So this is a great excuse to pull your player characters in the politics of your city or your country or whatever. You know, if one of them's throwing around a lot of money, they're going to get involved in that stuff, whether they want to or not, because other people in the city will see them as influential and will want to use them in their plots. And we have here some prices for food, drink, and lodging here on page 158. So this is very useful if you're not using cost of living or, you know, just any time the player characters go into an inn or something and they want to buy some ale or some wine or whatever, you've got those kinds of things here. We also have a little section here in regards to lifestyle about self-sufficiency. The expenses and lifestyles described in this chapter assume that you are spending your time between adventures in town, availing yourself of whatever services you can afford, paying for food and shelter, paying townspeople to sharpen your sword and repair your armor, and so on. Some characters, though, might prefer to spend their time away from civilization, sustaining themselves in the wild by hunting, foraging, and repairing their own gear. So we've got something for you guys. Maintaining this kind of lifestyle doesn't require you to spend any coin, but it is time-consuming. If you spend your time between adventures practicing a profession, as described in Chapter 8, you can eke out the equivalent of a poor lifestyle. So this is Chapter 8. We're talking about downtime stuff. So when we get there, if you're practicing one of those professions, you can have a poor lifestyle without paying for it, basically. Proficiency in the survival skill lets you live at the equivalent of a comfortable lifestyle. But again, that's out in the wilds. That's not in the city. You can't do that in the city, obviously. Next, we have a section on services. This covers all kinds of stuff, everything from, you know, hiring a coach to take you from A to B to hiring a spellcaster to cast spells for you. So here on the services table, we have a very few number of services listed here for you. So, for instance, you can get a coach cab, take you between towns. It'll cost you 3 coppers per mile, or take you from point A to point B within the same city will cost you a copper. We've got hirelings here, skilled at 2 gold per day or untrained at 2 silver per day. So I did an episode not too long ago about bringing hirelings and followers back into 5th edition. So here's a little bit of support we have for that here. Can get a messenger for 2 copper per mile. Suggested toll at a road or gate is 1 copper. And booking passage on a ship, it suggested, would cost you 1 silver per mile. So there you go. Here we have a section on spellcasting services. This is worth noting. People who are able to cast spells don't fall into the category of ordinary hirelings. It might be possible to find someone willing to cast a spell in exchange for coin or favors, but it is rarely easy and no established pay rates exist. As a rule, the higher the level of the desired spell, the harder it is to find someone who can cast it, and the more it costs. And something that I would take here from the pages of 1st edition DMG is I would tie the level of spell you can find a caster for to the size of the settlement. And, you know, you'd have to figure that out for yourself, how you want to do that, what fits your world. You know, for Primordia, I might say, you know, in a town, you might find someone that can cast 1st or 2nd level spells, but that's it. And even that's not guaranteed. If you want anything more than that, or if you want a good chance of finding someone that can cast spells at all, you'd have to go to a city. Hiring someone to cast a relatively common spell of 1st or 2nd level, such as Cure Wounds or Identify, is easy enough in a city or town and might cost 10 to 50 gold pieces, plus the cost of any expensive material components. That means when you look at a spell and you see that entry that says components, and it might say V, S, or M, and then it might list some components. If it lists components and those components have a price next to them, you have to pay for that. And this is something, you know, we're not really going to get nitty gritty into spells, I don't think. So I'll just say it now. DMs, please, for the love of your game, pay attention to the spells that your characters are using and look them up in the book and look at their components, because players, for whatever reason, may be innocent, may not, but players, for whatever reason, tend to overlook those costly components. Spells like Chromatic Orb, Identify, any kind of Raise Dead, Resurrection, any spell like that. Really obviously powerful spells like Stone Skin all have pretty pricey components. And it's not just having the money, you got to have the right component. And, you know, you can't necessarily buy a 500 gold piece diamond anywhere, right? So I see on actual plays all the time, I see players throwing these spells out left and right, and you know they're not paying for those components, and the DMs are just like, it's just going right over their head. So yeah, look at those material components. And that is a very important way that spells are balanced in this game. For instance, a spell Stone Skin is really powerful. It's a really powerful spell. And if you got player characters casting that left and right, it's crazy. I play a dwarf cleric in a game. He has Stone Skin as a domain spell. The dude is, 10th level now, I think? 10th or 11th level? I've never used it. Why? Because of the component. What is the component of Stone Skin? Diamond dust worth 100 gold, which the spell consumes. Every time you cast Stone Skin, 100 gold. Every time. And that's 100 gold in the form of diamond dust, which I'd say you need a city for that. You're not going to find diamond dust in a village or a town or anything like that. You have to go to a city. And, you know, you may not be able to get it right now. You may have to wait a few days. You know, I mean, think about this stuff. This is part of the balance of the game. This is part of the way that we keep players from abusing Stone Skin, is every time they use it, it costs them 100 gold. And they have to have the diamond dust. They have to go get it. They have to pay the money up front to have it. And they have to have it on their person, which means they're carrying this highly valuable diamond dust around all the time. It could be stolen. It could be lost. Right? So you got to remember this stuff, because, you know, if you ignore stuff like that, that's when the game gets out of hand. And that's when DMs have player characters they don't know what to do with and they're too powerful. It's like, well, are you making them buy all their components that they need to buy? Because if you're not, you're just kind of asking for it. All right, back to spellcasting services. So yeah, you know, a first or second level spell might cost from 10 to 50 gold plus cost of components. Finding someone able and willing to cast a higher level spell might involve traveling to a large city, perhaps one with a university or prominent temple. And this is something to think about, you know, world building. How common are spellcasters in your world? How common are high level spellcasters in your world, or mid level spellcasters, or low level spellcasters? How commonly do those spellcasters cast spells for other people for money? How easy is that kind of thing to find? The answers to those questions say a lot about your world and will have a huge impact on the feel of your world and where you fall on that low to high fantasy spectrum. So, you know, you want to think about it, and preferably before players are asking you if they can find someone to cast Raise Dead for them, which is a fifth level spell, I believe, which, going by what this is saying, to even have a chance, you'd have to go to a large city. And even then, it's not guaranteed. Even then, you're going to have to pay the cost of the material component, which, let's just look here, because all of those resurrection type magics have these expensive components. I think Raise Dead is like 500 gold. Let's see. Yep, Raise Dead, a diamond worth at least 500 gold. So you have to have 500 gold at least, could be more. GM could say, it's 600 for this diamond to use your spell. The spell consumes it, so it's gone, and it has to be a diamond. You know, even here in the modern United States, you can't necessarily find, you know, a diamond worth X amount just anywhere, right? So in a fantasy world, even more so. So think about that stuff. Once found, the spellcaster might ask for a service instead of a payment. Here's another great way for an adventure hook, GMs. You know, this is, you know, part of the art of GMing, I think, is keeping your eye open for opportunities that the players give you to do the things that you wanted to do anyway, right? So maybe I have this idea of this quest that I want the players to go on. I want them to go to a certain dungeon and find a certain magic item. I don't want them to have the magic item. I don't want them to keep it. I just want them to have to go find it, right? Well, if I have this idea in the back of my head and I'm looking for a way to make it happen without railroading the players, so it makes it seem organic, like the players brought this on, like it was their idea, not mine, right? So if I'm on the lookout for that and the players want a Raise Dead spell cast, instead of just being like, no, you can't find anyone that can find it or that can cast it. Or yeah, you find someone and he charges you the 500 gold for the diamond. He charges you 600 gold for the diamond. And then he's going to charge you, 500 gold or whatever to cast a spell. It'd probably be more than that. But anyway, whatever he charges you, instead of just saying that, I could still say that, but also you have to do this favor for him because he's the only guy around that can cast a spell. It's him or nobody, and you want your dead friend back. So he'll cast it for you. He'll even do it now so your buddy can be back. But you got to go to this place and get this thing for him, this magic item, which is in this dungeon that I want to do next, right? And now it just seems very organic, like just one thing flows into another. And the player characters might not even realize that I wanted to do this dungeon all along, and I just now use this as the way to hook them into it. So always be on the lookout for stuff like that. And, you know, when players want to do something, especially when they want to do something a little bit outside the box, that's the perfect opportunity to leverage to get something to happen in the game that you want to happen. So, you know, for me, I'd say, you know, player characters, you know, someone dies and instead of, you know, having a cleric in the group that can bring him back or just being like, well, he's going to make a new character. If they're like, hey, we want to go to Alandria and we want to find someone that'll cast Raise Dead for us, that's a little bit outside the box for me. You know, I mean, it's not like way outside the box, but it's a little bit like, you know, you don't necessarily assume they're going to do that. So that would be a great opportunity for me to bring in an NPC I want to bring in, maybe some kind of cleric NPC that I want to bring in, or to use that as a hook for the next adventure. Oh, well, yeah, you find this guy, but he needs you to do this favor for him. So, yeah, the more you can kind of weave those things together, the more organic the story feels, the less it feels like a railroad, the more it feels like the character, the players are choosing their adventures. And it just feels natural. It just feels like you're in a story. It feels more realistic. So once found, maybe the spellcaster asks for a service instead of payment. The kind of service that only adventurers can provide. Like retrieving a rare item from a dangerous locale or traversing a monster-infested wilderness to deliver something important to a distant settlement. Stuff like that. Next, we have trinkets. This is something a lot of us forget. I almost always forget this as a DM, and I'll have a player be like, hey, can we roll for trinkets? And I'm always like, you bet you can. So we've got 100 trinkets here. There is somewhere on Wizard's website, if you can find it on their terribly organized site, their trinkets that they had people come up with for Ravenloft for Curse of Strahd. So there's even more trinkets there. And I mean, you can make up your own. They're not hard to come up with. And these also can be things that you can put into treasure hoards or just have the characters come across, you know, randomly. So if you're ever, you know, wanting to hand out some loot and maybe you don't want to give out something like super powerful or something worth a lot of money, but you just want to give out something flavorful, check out the trinkets. And that is the end of chapter 5. And I have been rambling through this PHB for a while now, so I think we'll pause there. Well, that is going to wrap up episode 138 of Game Master's Journey. I want to thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you enjoyed putting chapter 5 of the Player's Handbook under the microscope today. Definitely give me some feedback on this series of going through the Player's Handbook and ultimately the DMG. We're going to kind of speed through the Player's Handbook. Once we get to the DMG, there's going to be more that I'm going to want to really dig into. But I'd love to hear from you what you think of these episodes. Hopefully, they're helpful to you. And again, you know, part of the reason I'm doing this is I've had so many requests from listeners to talk about how to play RPGs, how to GM RPGs, and how to play and run D&D specifically. And I can't think of a better way to really dig into all of that and give you as much help as I possibly can than going through these rule books and calling out ways that you can customize your game and make the experience exactly what you want, calling out rules that can be helpful for handling things on the fly or handling weird things that come up during the game. And just as a structure, as a way to start to show you different ways you can tailor your style as a GM to not only create the experience that you want at the table, but to also customize the game so that your players enjoy it more as well. So I hope that you have a chance to play your favorite RPG this week. I'll be back soon with another episode of Game Master's Journey. Until then, game on.
This has been a Starwalker Studios production, your source for quality gaming and hobby podcasts.
This episode's music, courtesy of Cloudwalker, Transboy, Renfield, Stanko, and Ish. See the show notes for more details at starwalkerstudios.com/gamemastersjourney.